Hey guys, got a little bonus episode for you. This is actually an interview that I did. I was the interviewee with Craig Weinberg on The Interview, or The Interview. Craig's podcast is it's different. It's not all it's all the things that interest him, and he does a really good job of talking to his guests and getting out what he wants out of them. So go check it out, The Interview, and you can listen to my episode with him right here.
John Stallone, daysinthewild.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's kind of a strange thing. This in 2021, I kind of expanded this show specifically to include all kinds of people that I find fascinating and doing things that I maybe wish I was doing and
nice.
Out in the world. And I just want to get their, you know, thoughts and see what makes them tick. So you were on that list. I followed your Instagram for several years now. And one of the things that I remember from you that really kind of made me, I went, holy crap, I'm not even close to the same level, is I think you were training for archery. Mm-hmm. And you were laying on your back with your bow on your front. And you drew laying down and then sat up at full draw to shoot.
Yeah.
Wow. And I get that. It makes perfect sense. You train like you want to, you're going to be, but wow. Well, when did you start doing that level of training?
That specific move actually started that in like 2004, 2005. I'm trying to remember if it was 2005, because in 2004 was my first antelope hunt. Matter of fact, it was in South Dakota.
Really?
Well, up by Buffalo. And I was finding that I would get in close enough to make a shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're hiding behind sagebrush that's 18 inches, 24 inches tall max. And, you know, to get drawn, you'd have to expose yourself and then, you know.
That's a lot of wasted time.
Yeah, exactly. So what I came back the following year, I came prepared, because the whole year after that, I started drawing back on my back and then sitting up. And by the time I sat up, I could acquire.
Wow.
Also, part of my, you know, my training is I've done a lot of drills and such that allow me to acquire a target quickly and shoot. And a lot of that came about because I do a lot of bow hunting for coyotes, and that's like a drive-by shooting. Like,
right. How in the world does that work?
Flying in, they stop for about a second max. You know, sometimes you get one that's, you know, real curious and he'll stop and poke around in the bush to try to find the call. But most of the time they get to about where the call is and they stop for, you know, they just basically pause. And you got that much time to acquire a target and shoot. So, you know, everything I do has come from finding out that I needed a solution in the field. You know, mm-hmm. I'm always looking for the silver bullet, basically, you know, and I practice that way year in, year out for as long as I can remember. It's funny because these last 2-3 years, I haven't trained with the same intensity and frequency that I normally had in past years.
Do you see different results because of that?
Yeah. Yep.
Really?
I have. Because your brain still says, hey, I know I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then your body goes to do it. And
your body says, uh-uh.
Nope. Exactly. You know, that getting older and all that. I'm freaking 45. Yeah. And it's not, you know. None of this stuff is as easy as it was when I was in my 20s and 30s. So,
Let's go back a little bit. How did you get into hunting at this level?
At this level? Okay. How did that start? I think that also started out of necessity, too. So, back early, was it in 99 or 2000? I wanted to watch hunting shows,
mm-hmm.
And they weren't available to me with the service, the, you know, cable service or whatever I had. And I said, wouldn't it be great if people could watch whatever they want to watch when they want to watch it? So,
revolutionary.
Yeah, except for that, I never had the money backing me to, you know, I was before YouTube, before any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I started going down this rabbit hole of developing an online TV network. And then in 2004, it came to fruition, which is the Hunting Channel Online.
Did you start that?
Yep, I did.
Really?
I did. Yeah.
What were the hurdles you ran into?
Well,
I mean, outside, I mean, just dollars. I mean, are there other, or is that it?
Dollars was a big thing at first. Technology was a huge thing. The technology really wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now the internet performs leaps and bounds faster, you know, than it did when I started this. And, you know, the file formats, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of process with that.
Yeah.
You had these SD video cameras filming to, you know, micro DV tapes and whatnot. And then you'd have to transfer those in real time, digitize them into the only format that was available. There was no MP3 or MP4 then. Or MP3 there was, MP4 there wasn't. So it was like an AVI file, or it was and they just were just large, just ginormous.
Upload for days.
Well, yeah, exactly. Things were just things were just slow, super, super, super slow. So that was a hurdle. The biggest hurdle I had actually was getting the contributors to get me the content on time. I did very, very well with it. You know, the first couple of years, man, so it was $1 a month was the membership. We had like 12,000.
12 bucks a year, really?
Yeah. We had 12,000 people. So it was $12,000 a month coming in. So we did real well. You know, I was able to pay out everybody I needed to pay out and still come away with some money for it from it. And I got into this situation with my web guy at the time, and he basically locked me out of everything. And even though the site ran, but it ran on idle for almost 2 years before I was able to legally get everything back and do what I had to do. And then by that time, you know, YouTube had came in, some of the other networks were there was online TV starting to pop up in my niche, even, you know, there's been so many online hunting TV stuff that has come and gone.
Yeah.
You know, TNN did something that, like, I was constantly competing with people who had way more backing than I did. But I'm still the first, and I'm still the only, I'm the oldest that's been out there. We've been there forever. The site itself right now needs a major overhaul. It's free at the moment. So like if you go on there, it's free, but it's filled with old content. I haven't updated the shows in a while. Mainly because I was about a year ago, I was in a merger to sell it, or not a merger, but I was in a contract to sell it all. And I that fell through. And so it's kind of been sitting idle right now. And, I'm debating what I'm going to do with it, because in the process of all this, right? Mm-hmm. So in the process of promoting the Hunting Channel, emerged John Stallone. Okay, emerged my popularity, because you know, I'm sitting here. I never wanted to be front and center of anything, but right. I just wanted a network, and I wanted it to do well, and I wanted to, you know, be able to make money off of it and you know, go hunting. So I was writing for people. And that's actually kind of where I really got started. My first thing in the pro, you know, world was writing articles for other magazines and stuff. But you know, I was constantly writing for our blog. I was writing for other people, and then I started my own TV show as a way to put that TV show on other networks to drive people back towards the hunting channel.
Right. As a marketing tool, basically.
Right. And then at some point, my TV show became more popular than the hunting channel. And I had this web show, you know, did it for almost 16 years, I think, before. Wait, I stopped in 2016, 14 years.
Wow.
14 years. And the podcast also, I did the podcast for 11 years. I did it for 7 years for the Hunting Channel Online only, and we only did one episode a month. And then, so you had to be a member to listen to it. Then, you know, back in 2015, I brought it to iTunes, or the end of 2015, I brought it to like iTunes and to the masses. So, basically the TV side of it, I stopped doing that in the end of 2016 just because that business model was dying. Ridiculous amount of money to produce a show, and I saw that the podcast had potential, and we were doing well with the podcast and just, you know, considerably growing exponentially. So I stopped the TV show, and I said, I'm just going to do a film, you know, maybe do a film a year or something, because I have a passion for it. I like capturing. I really like being able to go back and look at my hunts with my kids and all that other stuff. So I, you know, I've since then only done film format type, you know, videoing at that point. I don't do the TV show. That, or I do a quick, you know, for YouTube or for Instagram type videos, like a hunt condensed into 2-3 minutes type deal, you know.
Yeah.
Because today's day and age, if you're over 30 seconds, people don't want to watch it anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, Facebook, you know, they say 3 minutes is where it's at. And it, I mean, if you watch all the popular kids out there, it's a 3 minute. 3 minute, 3 seconds, 3 minute 10.
Yeah,
that's what they're pushing out, and I mean, the reach you get's insane.
Yep.
You know, thinking of hunting films, how has the final product changed over the last 20 years or so?
Oh my god!
And what is it different because the viewer wants more? I mean, or how much storytelling has to be built into it and drama to make it successful?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said I didn't take into consideration what the viewer wanted, but I think most of my decision making and changes I've done over the years have all just become, one, I got better at it, and two, just creative juices, you know? Like, I look back at my old stuff, and it's really obvious. It's really obvious that I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Yeah.
I really still don't. I mean, from a, you know, a real cinematographer situation, it's not, my stuff is nowhere near what you know, what they're producing in Hollywood and everything, and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, they have budgets though.
Yeah, true. So you know, I would say my stuff has become more beautiful. You know, it's got more of that, I hate the word, we use the word epic, but it's got more of that
kind of grand scale. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, where before it was a talking head telling a story and cutaways to
some bad B-roll.
Yeah, you know, to that. Now it's more like there's almost no commentary except for whatever's spoken in the field, and the story is told through the cinematography versus. Yeah. So now it lends itself to a lot of people to kind of draw their own conclusion to how how it all unfolds, where I was telling people, chronologically, this is how it went.
Right. And then walked down this ravine and we took 5 steps over here. Yeah.
But I think the whole industry has done that. Actually now, if you still go back and watch hunting TV, mm-hmm. especially if you watch, the Pursuit Channel, especially. Very,
really?
Very rudimentary, very old school style, and the guys like on Sportsman's, that are doing it differently, or, Steven Rinella, but he commentates throughout his whole thing, in the background, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
But Western Hunter, those guys do a great job of, portraying the journey through the actual, capturing of the footage,
So. Growing up out in the mountains of Oregon, we used to go to the library when I was little in the early 90s and like probably the late 80s too. And we would check out Larry D. Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Dwight Shue, Tink Nathan. It was caribou hunting. And I would watch those on repeat over and over.
Yeah.
And it was just so fascinating to get in the field. And I was just a little kid, and then fast forward to today, where the amount of drone technology that's out there to get sane footage is just, DJI just released a new FPV drone that's small and apparently phenomenal, like yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's just wild. So is gear important when you're out there? And do you plan a hunt based on the shots now?
I don't plan, period. No. I used to try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I used to try to plan the story in my head almost before it happened. And it's like, you can't do that because the hunt is going to be the hunt.
Yeah.
The animals, the situations, all that stuff is going to dictate how it all unfolds, and all unfolds. No. Simple answer is no. I don't plan. But I do go in with an idea in my head that I know I wanna have this style, like an over the shoulder style, or I wanna have a first person, or a POV type.
Yep.
Those type of things, yeah, I'll go in with that idea, but not much further than that. As far as equipment's concerned, you'd be surprised. I actually have, if you look at some of my films, they were done, or some of my videos, they were done on my iPhone.
Well, nowadays, that's a cinema machine in your pocket now.
Right, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
A lot of it back in the day was like, you got to get this freaking cameras and this camera and that camera. Mm-hmm. If you got a really good camera and it's in the hands of the right operator, then, but if you can have the best camera in the world and you don't know how to use it and you don't have a good eye for shots. Like I was lucky. I groomed a couple of guys really early on. Levi Paul, he's been, still does stuff for me here on and off, but he's been with me since he's like 15 or 16 years old. He was a kid. Now he's in his 30s. He works for a corporate AV company. But, he always had a good eye and he was a good hunter too to begin with. So it was easy. That had another guy named Nick that was just, and Nick still does work for me. Nick is the opposite. He wasn't the greatest hunter, and I always had to like teach him, as we went along. But what a fantastic, eye. Then I had another kid who worked for me for a while too. His name was Tanner Kemp. He had the best of both worlds. He was a good hunter, and he was a pretty good operator. He had a good eye maybe he wasn't as technically as sound, but he had like really, he knew what shots to get, you know, and those are the important things, like knowing what shots to get. Like from my father is a photographer. He is about as technically advanced as a, you know, chimpanzee when it comes to using technology. Right. And he's got this like $8,000 camera that he has no clue how to use. But my father really has an eye for composition. You know, he knows how to capture the shot and what's a cool action shot. What's, you know, he anticipates what's going to happen, and he gets to that spot and gets, you know, so those are the things that make good film. Cause you could have $5 million. You could have a freaking Red Dragon out there and your film's going to look like shit. It might actually look even worse because that camera's so involved.
Well, it's so manual. Like you have to know the settings. The iPhone has done such a great job of taking all the work out of it.
Yep. Yeah. I know guys that put rigs on iPhones and do tons of work. Yeah.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on like ATN? You know, they make these 4K thermal scopes and, you know, they've got SD cards in them and they'll record what you're looking at. What do you think about that kind of stuff?
I think it's cool. It's got its place. Yeah, it's got its place. I haven't used any of that. Well, I shouldn't say haven't. I've used some former, you know, usages of that, or we've connected phone scope. You know, we connect the phone scope all the time with scopes and all that stuff to get that, you know, crosshair or whatever type shot. And that's still real popular. I mean, in the end, I would say the majority of the viewers always want to see a kill shot. You know.
Well, that was where my next question was, how important is that and where does that need to be in the film? Like, is that something you show first and then call back to it? Or because a lot of shows tease that, like they'll put, almost got him. And then they give you 20 minutes of commentary before they get to it.
Right. You know, that's a tactic. I've gone to that here and there before. For the most part, I don't. I usually like to tell the story. You know, we started here and we end up here, you know. I find that that's, for me, is better. Like, I think if I kind of know what's going to happen, then it loses some of the suspense. It's like, why do I really even care what, you know, I wanted to get to that point and see how you got that animal, but you kind of already showed me.
Right. So we're done. If I don't like that end result, I won't bother with the story.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, what do you think about the politics of hunting and filming it? You know, there's a certain group of people in the world that think it's horrible and bad. Okay. And, you know, if you show that, you're harming children, you know, because they would see death and all kinds of stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well,
I mean, clearly that's not something you agree with, but
that's a very long road that we don't have enough time for me to talk about. But in a nutshell, I think it is our duty as content producers, and everybody out there is now producing content because we all have cell phones. We're all posting on internet, you know, social media, Instagrams, you know, all that crap. That to put it in a tasteful light, we all know that there are points in hunting, and I used to be that guy that I showed everything. I showed the bad shot. I showed the unrecovered deer. I did all that, and I caught a lot of flack for it. And I got a lot of praise for it too, because there's people.
Well, because you were showing the reality of it.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's people on both sides of the fence of it. But more and more, I'm seeing that it is important for you. I don't know when I took Hunter's Ed. One of the things they taught us was, don't strap the deer to the hood of your car, and drive it to the center of town and show it off. Don't push death and hunting, whatever, in people's faces that might not want to be able to see it, that might not want to see it. So, and that kind of resonated with me. And I mean, that was back when I was like 9, I think I took that class. 9, no, I think it might have been 11 in New York. Anyway, but it resonated with me and it kind of stuck with me for years. But, you know, there was a large portion of my career where I was like, I want to be as truthful and honest with what I do,
mm-hmm.
And show everything. And then from that point, it went to, you know, how can I show just the good stuff of what happened? And it's kind of a, you know, it's a mixed, you know, it's mixed emotions because you want to be able to be real, you know, but at the same time, you also want to show the most tasteful things in the most tasteful light.
Yeah.
So like now when I take photographs, I try to make sure there's no, you know, not super bloody or anything like that. I don't, your traditional hero shots, I still take those also, you know, your grip and grins and stuff like that. We take those, but I also take, I make sure the camera's going the whole time. So when I'm walking up, revering the animal, you know, looking it over. I also, now is one of the things that I think is super important. I make it a point to take photographs of the meat, processing it, hanging it in trees, all that stuff. Because I can't tell you how many times over the years I'd be like, oh, I see the head on your backpack, but I don't see the meat. Okay, well, the meat's in another backpack or another sack, and it's inside, and you don't see it because it's not on the outside. You know, you know, and that to me, there's a lot of uneducated people, or I don't like to use the word ignorant, but it's, or naive. Naive is probably better.
Yep.
They don't understand because they've never done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't understand that you might pack out this and then pack out that and whatever. And just because you don't have a picture of that or whatever. So I make sure that I have that. So when people are like, oh, do you eat that? Oh, yeah, of course, here. This is what I do. And now a lot of times I'll even show the finished product. You know, I made tostadas or I made, you know, pastrami or whatever out of that meat. So they can see it from start to finish. And I can't tell you, one, it's gone over well with the hunting industry, which I knew it would, because people like to see that stuff. But it's gone over really well with the non-hunting. You know, the anti is never going to be.
You're
not going to you're not changing those minds, right?
Yeah.
You're not changing those minds. And we don't really care about changing those minds. We just don't want the non-hunters to migrate over to anti-hunting. We just want them to sympathize with us.
So how do we get, and why is it important to teach the next generation the whole picture, the value of hunting and what it's really for? Because, you know, that we could go down the trophy hunting world, you know, and so you're going out there because I want a big mount on the wall, forget the rest. Where is that balance, and how do we draw the next generation into it properly?
Well, drawing the next generation into it properly, I mean, it really just comes down to each individual dad and mom and uncle or whatever that's taking the kids out, or mentors, and them just showing them the whole process, that it's not just about pulling the trigger. It's not just about, you know, ending up with a set of horns or whatever. And getting them involved in cooking. And getting them involved in the processing. So my daughter, Ella, she's 11. She's about to turn 12. She's already taken 3 big game animals.
Wow.
Yeah, she's spoiled because she's got, you know, guide daddy taking her to. And she, which is, it's a double-edged sword, because now, like, if we go 2-3 days and then we haven't gotten something, she's like, what the hell, Dad?
Come on, guide.
I want to go home. This is getting boring, you know. But it's she's kind of really embraced like eating the meat and all that stuff.
Really?
Yeah, I know. It's like I started out with all of them, with learning how to shoot bows and stuff like that. And you know, the normal progression. We would go hunting with slingshots, and just I think slowly taking them in from and taking them on all these different types of adventures that are hunting adjacent.
Yeah.
And that you can incorporate some type of hunting with it. it allows them to kind of see the big picture, and then teaching them what conservation is and teaching them why we are an important part of the system, why it's necessary. I think that's, you just can't, it can't be one-sided. You know, you gotta give them it, the whole picture, and give it to them in chunks that they can digest, because you can't throw it all at them, especially, you know, I started my kids off young. I mean, Ella, heck, all three of them, they were shooting, you know, a little recurve bow that, oh, I thought I had it hanging up there, but I don't, you know, at like 2 years old, you know, with my help, of course, and me, you know, helping them hold back and all that stuff. But it there was lessons in everything, you know, oh, I can do this. You know, there's physical lessons, there's mechanical lessons, there's, you know, all these like social lessons and stuff that have come with it. And it gives them confidence, and it gives them a direction that, you know, it's, even though hunting is the main goal for me to get them into that, it has all these, what's the word I'm looking for? Positive side effects, I guess, you know?
Well, and they get to learn that, well, knowing where your food comes from is a huge piece of that. And then understanding that the hunting world, really, the conservation is a piece of it, and maintaining the outdoors. And that's something that I've found kind of intriguing with the anti-hunting crowd, is their whole thought that hunting is bad, you're going to ruin the world.
Yeah.
Well, if you allow things to go uncontrolled at some level, it gets worse.
Right.
You know, like I've watched a few, you know, giraffe hunts over the years online. You know, they're conserving, and really what they're doing is they're getting rid of some pretty dangerous big bulls out of there.
Right.
And the local communities benefit greatly when this happens, with income and food. I mean, the meat stays there.
Right.
But it's almost, it seems really difficult to get that concept across, that this is actually, that there's a positive to continuing on the outdoors as we know it and making it better by doing this.
Right. What people need to realize is that we've been a part of the system, okay? And I'm not talking about the system that's been put in place by the government and our conservation. We've been a part of the circle of life. Yeah, okay? Let's look at it from that 30,000 foot view. The circle of life since the beginning of time, you know, we were hunters, gatherers, whatever.
Yeah,
that's part of who we are and what we do. And you know, the people that make the argument that if we just leave things alone, the predators will keep the, it doesn't work that way, because for one, we've had our hands in management, and we have disrupted so much of natural habitat with our cities and our roads and our infrastructure that it is impossible for things to go back. Yeah, if you're talking about maybe the most untouched corner of their world that, you know, man hasn't interjected, there was a possibility for it. But I mean, for instance, we here in Arizona, how do I put this without throwing people underneath the bus, we have an area, okay, that is managed by a government entity, okay?
So, and diplomatic of you, I like it.
And there is a bunch of water holes, developed water holes on this piece of land that were there for basically about 100 years, okay? Now, 100 years later, some, you know, guy comes in and says, well, we don't need all these things because the mule deer survived before, you know, this, they survived in this landscape before those were there and dismantled all of them.
Wow.
The mule deer herds for 5 years suffered so badly that they had to go back and start rebuilding all these water holes. Because again, 100 years ago, one, the climate was different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hell, 25 years ago, the climate was different here when the rain patterns were different. The landscape, the vegetation, all, everything was different and better than it is now. So that idea that, oh, things will just write its, you know, nature will write itself. Yeah, mm-hmm. It possibly could, but at what cost?
And how long?
And how long? Exactly. When are we going to see that come back? So, you know, I'm a big believer that if you enter a system in at any level, there's a yin and a yang, there's a push and a pull. So you have to manage everything holistically. And because we're altering habitat, because we are growing as a population, hell, when I was a kid, there was 4 billion people in the world. Now there's 8 billion people in the world, and I'm 45. Okay. So, you know, we're not going to manage people. We're not going to go out and start culling people, right? So,
well, we shouldn't.
No.
And that gets messy.
Yeah. I mean, they're probably trying to do that with this coronavirus right now anyway, but that's a tinfoil hat discussion that we can stay away from.
Wait, you have one of those? Yeah. Is that what's in the back corner?
Along with all the other shit that's piled up back there. But yeah, it's, you know, that idea is just, it's ludicrous. You know, what needs to happen is really sound science, really sound management policies, and we just need to constantly be evolving and changing with, you know, from year to year because of the animals themselves, because of weather patterns, because of what, you know, and just stay on top of it and be good stewards of the land, and everything will be fine. But
well, you do get some crazy people that don't think that through, and so they just want to go shoot things. Mm-hmm. And so you get some crazy. Is that why we have accepted as a society this idea that I have to go essentially pay the man to have access to go harvest animals?
Well, no, I mean that's a very smart system that was put in place, honestly. The North American conservation model is very complex, but it's a really, really good model. And having to pay for the right to go out and shoot stuff, none of that should really bother anybody, because that money, if it's done the way it was written to be done, which it isn't always, is... It goes to everything that it needs to go to. Like, I'll leave it at that. You know, let's leave that, 'cause I don't want to get into another political deal about it. But the idea of the way it's supposed to work is correct, in my opinion. And I think where I'm kind of losing my train of thought here, 'cause I started thinking about politics for a second, but the,
do you really, sorry.
Yeah, I'm very easily squirrel. Yeah, I developed ADD as I got older,
as an adult.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think the idea, like the crazy person out there and all that, I think that was all. If you let me back up, if you look through time, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hunter's always painted as a villain. You see it in Disney, you see it in Hollywood. Right. I mean, the general view of who the hunter is of the non-hunting public, and definitely from the anti-public, is Elmer Fudd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just out there, or you're like a toothless redneck hillbilly just running around drinking beer, shooting shit out of the back of your truck.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, there is a small population of people that are like that. And because of them, they shit all over the rest of us. I mean, I look at you, and hopefully this doesn't offend you. I don't say, this guy's a freaking hunter.
You look right.
Like, I mean, you look like, you know, that you carry a briefcase to work every day. So,
shoot, I'm doing something wrong.
I mean, I know you got the beard going and all that, but this has a little bit of rebel right there. But it's just, you look real clean cut. You're put together. I don't think people look at me when I'm out to dinner with my wife and go, "Oh, that guy's a hunter." You know, there's nothing that sets us apart from.
Yeah.
Or that says hunter when you see us, you know. I guess that's what my point is. So
is that based on some stereotype that Hollywood has created?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, and the more and more I get into politics, and which I don't want to, but the more I look into it, it's like, man, there seems to be this like one side. I'll say it, like this leftist deal that they were really smart, man. They got into all the places that matter when it comes to perception. Mainstream media, Hollywood, you know, even music, all that stuff. It's all
how you craft the narrative.
Exactly.
As you get into those places to tell the story.
Exactly. I mean, they control. I mean, now look, too, big tech, like all Facebook, Instagram, friggin' Amazon, all those companies, Apple, they're all kind of on that side, you know? They're, as much as they tell you they're not, they're on that side. And, man, we are seeing. Well, we were just having this conversation, a couple of us influencers on Instagram, that we're seeing this trend of censorship, or not, it's not really censorship. So they can, you know, they can control the valve of how many people see what you do.
Right.
Every time I make a post that's politically charged, I get punished for about a week. All my subsequent.
And how? Like stuff just doesn't get distributed?
All my subsequent posts after that, I see a serious decline in engagement.
And that's a pattern that's you can watch.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And like 2 years ago, maybe almost 3 years ago, this is like right after Trump came in. Prior to Trump coming in, I had like, let's say 17,000 followers, 16,000 followers on Instagram at that point. And I would average somewhere between 500 to 700 likes per post.
Yeah.
On my hotter, you know, my more intriguing content. And then, you know, on the less intriguing stuff, half of that. Okay. Now I have 26,000 or something like that. I don't even know, but somewhere around that. And I make a post, and I only get 200 or 300 likes. Every once in a while, I see the 5 or 6 because it's a really, you know, cool thing. But
so, is that a throttle issue on Instagram's part?
I think so. I think most of the people, and so I look at some of my friends that don't have that problem. Like one of my buddies, Ryan Carter, all his posts are like trail camera videos of live animals. So he continues to grow, and he continued like, so because it's not, I guess maybe the algorithm doesn't pick him up as whatever, or they don't see him as a
threat. Just say it.
I don't know. I don't know what it is, but for the most part, most of the guys that are like me that kind of give you a little bit of everything, we see this throttling back. Matter of fact, Donald Trump Jr. made a post about it yesterday, right after me and my other buddies were discussing it. Very similar. So, anyway, we got way off the topic here.
Shadow ban concept, the idea, and it really comes down to, and you know I've seen it in other elements also. It comes down to controlling the narrative. I really think that's where it's at. Across the board. And you know, you can say your band, you know, will shut you down. That's kind of that's bold and it gets a lot of press. But if you just slowly squeeze the tube, and you know, just close the door a little bit. It's hard to blame. It's hard to prove. And we don't do that. It must just be the people. Your people must not be really paying attention to your content. So it's your fault.
Yeah. Well, listen, in my opinion, I know why they do it, even with people who are not in the industry or not on the right. They do it to lefties also, but it's to make more money because they want you to pay for boosting and whatever, all that stuff. That's how it started off. But then they realized that, wow, we can really control what the hell we want people to think and see and whatever. You know, it was a tool, I think, that was developed to make money.
So do you think any of it has to do with the bigger advertisers that are using, they're actually buying into this to advertise on these platforms? And if, so they're complaining about content?
If that was the case, then every third picture I freaking scroll through on my Instagram feed now wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of people in our niche in, you know, guns, fitness, trucks, whatever. ATVs, there's plenty of people that fall into that niche that are spending the money. So no, I don't believe that to be true. So we're working on a project now. One of my partners, Charles Whitwam, and myself are, and a few other people, working towards trying to, now specifically for hunting. And the reason why we started going down that road is I wanted to say this, and I guess I didn't say it at first. So before I tell you about this project, is that the rest of the world is seeing now, I think, what hunters have kind of been experiencing long before. With the whole narrative thing, the whole, So, I think it's just getting a lot larger, a lot broader. It's, you know, it's definitely more politically charged now and so on and so forth. But I think that whole scenario has been there for us since the dawn of time.
Well, yeah, BAMP.
Maybe not the dawn of time, because in the dawn of time, we were, if you think about it, back in the day, the hunter was.
We're the good guy.
We were revered. We were the people who. Yeah, exactly. Now we're the world. We're the enemy. But going back to what I was saying about the project is we're working on something to kind of bring a unity to hunters and give our voice, because we're strong, we're powerful, we spend a lot of money, there's a lot of us, more so than the anti-hunting. And if we're able to channel all that, you know, into one focused blow, when and where we need it, then I think it'll change the game.
So that's awesome.
That's all I'm going to say about it, because it's still kind of in the works, and I don't want to look out.
That's great. Egg, but we'll keep an eye on it, definitely, because when it gets out, it'll be cool. Why is bow hunting so important?
To me, or just in general?
Yeah, to you. Like, because bow is your go-to.
Yes, it is.
Product.
For sure. Absolutely. Honestly, I don't know, man. It's kind of, I'm drawn to it. I'm drawn to it like I'm drawn to the mountains. Like, it's like a calling. It, like, see, if I handed you my rifle, okay, and I told you to go lay down over there and put this crosshairs and shoot that target at 300 yards, I know my rifle's dialed in. You do what mm-hmm. you got to do. It's going to work, right?
Yeah.
But I can't hand you my bow and say, go shoot, go shoot that target at 80 yards and shoot it the way I shoot it.
Yeah.
There's, it's an extension of you. It becomes part of you. There's a lot that you put into it, and there's, you know, because you can hunt with a rifle the way you hunt with a bow. If you want to get up close and personal, you could do all that stuff. But there's just so much more that it's, I don't know, it becomes you. It becomes
so does the hunt become as important as the success then? Like that becomes the success in an archery hunt?
It's always been, at least for me. Like mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, like if you get into bow hunting because you want to, you know, harvest more animals or whatever, you're going to be more disappointed than you ever were before, because it's not about that. It's about everything. It's about the birds, the bees, the wind, the, you know, everything is just, you got to be out there for the whole experience of it. And for me, I think, I don't know, I tell people all the time that I'd rather fail with my bow than succeed with the rifle. It's just a different sense. It's just a different yeah. sense of accomplishment when things go right. The feel of it, and I, like I said, the actual bow itself feels like, it feels like it's an extension of you. You feel like, you know, you're happy when you coach a kid in soccer, but you're even more happy when that kid is your kid. You
yeah.
know, like that's the difference right there. Like mm-hmm. that's the only way that I could think of it equating it. But of course, people who don't have children probably won't understand that. But
you're absolutely right. It so, is that.
Yeah.
What's the most important tool in your bag?
Me.
Well, you prepared?
Yeah. It's about what it's about what I've done leading up to that point.
Okay.
It does. It's like going back to the camera. It doesn't matter how freaking good your mm-hmm. tools are. I mean, you want good tools because they allow you to, you know, go to your potential. But
yeah,
you don't want to be limited by your tools in any way, shape, or form. But it doesn't matter. You can have the best of the best if you don't take the time to prepare. It's yeah. not going to make a difference.
What's your most memorable or / wildest hunt story?
Man.
I mean, you probably have none, so.
Yeah, I don't. I don't because know, man. There's I've so seen many.
Pictures of you with some massive, like, rams. And yeah. that just would be a fascinating concept. Like, to go do that, that'd be so nuts.
I mean, there's been so many times where... Yeah, I was actually just having this conversation with one of the kids that came to, he guides for me now, but he used to, he'd come and help. He was actually on my second Ibex hunt, and we were just talking about this one time where we were out on this ledge, and he's like, I'm not going out there any further. This is crazy, you know, and I'm like sitting there on
a... Like ledge, like a drop-off ledge?
I mean, plummet to your death.
Oh, man.
Kind of stuff, yeah. Yeah, I was standing on 4 inches of rock, mm-hmm. leaning up against another rock and drawing back and trying to shoot another, you know. So there's a lot of those, but it's funny, the ones that stand out to me are not even those. It's the ones that were, well, hell, like, for instance, this, I just guided some javelina hunters, and my client, she shoots this pig. I watch it drop and it roll, does a little slow death roll, and it stops in a bush, feet up. And I'm like, all right, cool, done. Let's, all right. I'm like, all right, her husband. I'm like, all right, let's try to get on this other one before they get out of here. And I get him laid down, and unfortunately he shot right as the pig decided to take a couple steps forward, and he hit right behind it. So we had to like scramble, get around the mountain because they went up and over. climb up this other ridge. I relocated him. He shoots, makes a great shot. Now we drop back down to the truck, like, you know, drop like 300-400 feet in elevation, drop back down to the truck, swing back around, go up. We dump all our stuff at the truck. I'm like, all right, I got a mental idea where this pig that she shot is. Let's go get hers first, and then we'll drop down to get yours because there's a more distinct marker. And whatever. So we go up there, climb. It was about 600-foot climb. Get up there, and the pig jumps up.
The one that was feet up?
Yep. Pig jumps up and runs about 30 yards and stops. And I'm like, we don't have a gun.
Oh, no.
We left everything at the truck. And I'm like, all right, just stay here. Keep an eye on him. I gave the husband my binos. I'm like, you keep an eye on him. I slowly get back, you know, down the mountain, grab the rifle, run back up the bridge, get her with the rifle, just about to shoot it. The pig takes off again, drops down this cut, and starts going up the other side. She shoots him and rolls down into this cut. I got to, like, climb down these rocks and boulders to get this thing and haul him back out and bring him back up to where the husband's pig was, you know, like several hundred yards away. It was just, it's like, those are the things that stick out to me. Like these crazy, like, moments that you share with other people. You know, like the memorable hunts with my family, my cousins and my friends, my close friends. Those are the ones that, like, yeah, I mean, I've shot sheep. I've shot ibex and giant elk and, you know, great bucks and all that stuff. Like, it's the adventures that stick out to me, not necessarily the, you know, here we're talking about a javelina, which is probably the lowest on the totem pole of big game animals, you know, and I'm getting excited about it because it was a crazy situation and I learned something from it. Like, I don't care how certain you are that both those animals are dead, bring a freaking gun with you, you know?
Right.
You know, this is,
wow.
But, yeah, I think those are the ones that stick out to me the most.
That's very cool. What's the last thing you learned?
The last thing I learned?
Yeah.
Well, I just told you never go get a downed animal without a rifle.
There you go.
No, but let's see. What's the last thing I learned? Let's see, something other than that. I don't think it's the last thing I learned, but it's something that I relearn time and time and again, year in, year out, is it ain't over till it's over. Mm-hmm. Never give up. Constantly, if you're even on your walk back to the truck, hunt to your, you know, to the back, to the way to the truck, like it's always going on. I can't tell you how many times that I get a little lazy or whatever the case may be, and just all of a sudden, boom, there's the opportunity. And if I had been focused or whatever,
yeah,
I could have capitalized on it. So I guess one of the biggest lessons that I learned, and I continue to learn, because it doesn't always register in the old noggin there, is to always be in it, you know, and it ain't over till it's over.
Nice. You have sponsors you want to talk about? You have any people that help support you, keep things going?
Well, Phoenix Shooting Bags is my number one sponsor. I actually did away with traditional sponsorship several years ago. I still ambassador for several companies, Matthews being one of them, Gold Tip, Sitka, and I ambassador that to, you know, I'm an ambassador to them, and I'm a proponent of what they do because of the quality and advances they keep making, you know, within what they do. So I continue to use their stuff. I continue to drive people towards their stuff in a non-traditional sense. Like when I get a lot of people ask me, my my wife tells me all the time, if I got $5 for every time somebody sent me a DM with a question, right, you know, we'd probably be working a lot less. But, you know, when people talk to me, like I win wars for them in the trenches. I got really tired of being a cheerleader years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that. And the hunting industry made it such, the TV industry especially made it such that you had to do that. You had to be like, look at this product. And everybody was,
right. Yeah.
Everybody's Vanna Whiting, you know, this stuff. And you know half the time they're snake oil salesmen and they're just saying what they're saying because they have to pay their bills. And I made it a point really early in my career never just to promote anything I didn't like, number one. But like I said, probably in the last 5 or 6 years, I really don't do the traditional, oh, go check out this and check out that.
Right.
Because those who follow me and who are really going to listen to me already know what I use. They see it.
Right.
I don't have, they see a picture with me with a Matthews bow and wearing Sitka. They know I'm using that for a reason. And I'm not saying go do it because I get a free bow or, you know, whatever,
yeah,
free camouflage or whatever this case may be. But so,
that's the place people to reach you, davesinthewild.com. What are your social media channels?
In Instagram, it's just John Stallone. Facebook, just John Stallone. YouTube, you could just look me up as John Stallone also.
Yeah, I think I did. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah, even though my actual channel still says Hunting Channel on YouTube. But yeah, that's it. And probably Twitter says Hunting is also done by Hunting Channel as well. The podcast is Days in the Wild.
Where the podcasts are sold.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So, but I think you can get to all that stuff right from daysinthewild.com.
Perfect.
I think there's, you know, links to everything there.
Awesome. Well, John, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing some of your life with us.
Yeah, that's absolutely. It was fun.
Very cool.
How fun. It's not much too much appreciated. I'm not used to talking about myself. It's funny. I do this, you know, two, three times a week, and I'm not used to being on the other side.
I'm a photographer as a career, and I'm rarely in front of the camera, so I know what you mean.
All right. Well, awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day.
Take it easy.